Today is June 26, 2012. This is Desiree Hargis working on behalf of the H.J. Lutcher Stark Center for Physical Culture and Sports. As part of the 1968 U.S. Olympic Team Oral History Project, I'm interviewing Lee Evans over the phone about his experiences in the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City. Warren?
Do you want me to start now?
Yes.
Okay. My name is Lee Edward Evans. I was born in Madera, California in 1947.
And did you grow up there?
Yes. I started school when I was 4 years old. We moved from Madera to Fresno, California. So I started my schooling in Fresno at Madison Junior High School, I think. Madison Elementary School in Fresno. And I was there for 8 years, kindergarten through the eighth grade. And then I started high school at Central Union High School. It's in the out in the county of in Fresno. We were very close to the city of Kermit. But we were in the Fresno School District.
Okay. And so tell me a little bit about high school. Well, before we talk about high school, can you tell me when you first got involved in track and who some of your major influences were in getting you involved in track at that time?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I loved running. And I remember there was one man who lived on our street named Mr. Scott. On late summer evenings, he would line all of us boys up, and he would have us race each other. And this is when I learned that I could run pretty good. But there was always one guy named Curtis Washington who could beat me every time. Curtis was really a stocky guy, so he had, I understand why he was beating me then, because I'm a coach. He had the power, and I didn't have power. I was a tall, skinny guy, so he could get going a lot faster than I could. So, but I was always second behind Curtis in the 100 meters. But then when we move up to 400, then I would always win that. But that's when I was in the eighth grade the first time that I raced in a competition. I was in the eighth grade that we went to, I think, Washington Union High School for some competition for junior high school kids. I remember the coach told us 2 weeks before, so we trained for 2 weeks. And the coach didn't know what to tell us to do, so we just raced each other every day, and that was our training. And so we would go there, and we would do pretty good. Curtis would win the 75 out of 100, and I could win the 400.
Okay.
And then, okay, and now that was in junior high. Then I went to Central Union High School, and my older brother Doug, who was 5 years older than me, was a great athlete. He ran 48.5 in the 400 and 155 in the 800 when he was in high school in 1959.
Mm.
And I think he graduated from high school in 1959 from Central Union High School, and he was my big influence for wanting to be a runner. He would win all the time, and he would bring his relay team from way back, and it became a dream of mine to be able to do the same. And so, and he was, he was my main. Obviously, he was my first coach. His name was Douglas Evans, and he was my first coach. And then when I started high, I used to run what they call the C-class 60-yard dash. I was C-class because I weighed about 80 pounds, and they added up your age, your weight, and your height, and they put you in different categories, A, B, or C. I was so small, they put me in C-class. But I didn't lose a race running the C-class. I ran the 60-yard dash. And when I was 15 years old, I ran 129.2. was my time. And I reached the Valley Finals The Valley Finals, it was like in the Fresno San Joaquin Valley. The competition you would have to run in to make it to the state meet, the California state meet. And California only has one division. There's no class A, B, C like they do in most states. It's, you know, if your school has 400 students, you compete against the school that had 3,500. You know, they didn't separate the two like most states do. So it was a big honor to make it to that meet. So in that meet, my freshman year, I didn't do very well at all. Because they went by components, you know, your age, your weight, and your height, there was always some little short Mexican guys that were, you know, like seniors in high school, and I was just a freshman, and they would be able to run 125 and 126. And when I finally ran against those guys, man, they cleaned my clock. So that was the last race of the year, the Valley Finals. But, you know, C-class cannot go to the state meet. So the next year, I got a little stronger. You know, as you get stronger, you can run faster. Next year, I got stronger and a little bit taller, but I was still C-class. But now I had speed. You know, before I used to run the 600 and the 800. I ran the 800 as a freshman as well. And I would always win, but I really didn't have a lot of speed. But my sophomore year, speed came from somewhere because I was running the 300. It was a 330-yard dash. Nobody in the Valley could beat me in a 330-yard dash. I think I still have the Valley record. I ran 36.0 when I was 16 years old. And I'm happy when my athletes run 36 in training now. I ran that when I was 16.
That's amazing.
But after that sophomore year of high school, we moved from Fresno to San Jose, California. My mother had contacted this sickness they called the Valley Fever. And what it was is really her lungs were infected from the, you know, we used to work through the farm labor work. And they have some bug that can get into your lungs, and she got it from working in the, we used to work in the harvest there all the time. Cotton, grapes, anything that was ready to harvest, we used to be involved with the harvest. So we moved to a wetter climate, and San Jose was a little wetter than Fresno. Mm-hmm. And I finished high school here in San Jose. But my junior year in high school, I don't know what happened, man. I got muscles and everything. And so I went out, I played football. I played defense in football. I was a linebacker.
Oh, wow.
I could just get to the ball. I could get to the ball quick. But I still weighed about 120 pounds. I wasn't packing a lot of power at all. But I got stronger my junior year. And I didn't lose any race until I went to the state meet. I was a bad guy, boy. the best guy in the valley and in our section, we would call the central section. You know, Fresno was central, and we was like north central, and they called the central coast section. That's what we would call.
Okay.
You know, in the San Jose area and parts of San Francisco, but San Francisco had their own associates. But anyway, I beat everybody in the 800 and the 400 and the 200 also. My junior year, I ran for 400 meters, I ran 47.9. I ran it in the state meet where I tied for third with Grundy Harris from Jefferson High School. And so that, you know, In Northern California, I had only ran 49.0. And I didn't run 48 till I went to the state meet. And in the semifinal, I ran 48.7 and placed second in my semifinal, so I made it to the final.
Mm.
And this is where, this is when I ran 47.9 and tied for third. You know, Freddie Banks from Jefferson won it in 47.0. This guy, Williams from Chaffee High School in the L.A. area there, took second. And I was third with the Grundy Harris from Jefferson. But that was the last time those guys could hang around, which would be close to me when I ran. Because when I had my first year of college, I was at San Jose City College. It was my freshman year, and I didn't lose a race to anybody in anything. You know, I had an 800, but I think at indoors, we won the national junior college record for the indoor sprint medley relay, and I ran 148 on my leg, and like this is like in January. And when I was 19, I didn't get tired. And in the outdoors, you know, to make it to that indoor meet, that was at the Cow Palace, San Francisco indoor meet at the Cow Palace, you had to qualify. So all the junior college had this big competition. I ran 153 on my relay leg for our team to make it to the indoor meet. And so I didn't ask when people said, who's this? I think I was still 17. No, I was still 18. Yeah, I was 18. I turned 19 in February 25th. So this is in January. And then the outdoors, I was undefeated. I could run anything, 800, 400 hurdles, 400, 200. I even ran the 100 one time. And I beat all the guys that, you know. But I didn't like the 100 meters, too short. I like to run. She shoot the gun, 100 meters, and it was over. I look around, I say, what happened?
Yeah.
What was all that about, you know? I said, oh, Coach, I don't want to run the 100, man. It wasn't fun. I like to run.
Mm-hmm.
So I became very good in the 400 and the 200. But if I had to run the 800, I could run that also. So I ran 46.6. I ran 46.6 in high school. I think I didn't tell you that. That was my best time in high school.
Wow.
So when we started running outdoors, my freshman year in college, I was running like 46.1, 46.2. I wouldn't even be tired at the end. And I was running them even. If I ran 46.2, I'll go 23.1 and come back 23.1. You know, I didn't understand it, but, you know, what it was, I was just striding that. 23.1 is really slow. You know, I could run the 200 by this time, 21.0, with my best 200 meter time my first year in college. And so 23.1 was like a strong stride for me.
Mm-hmm.
So I was running 46.2. It was easy. And so when we went to, I won the Northern California AAU Championship, which means that they pay you a ticket to the national championship. So my coach and I, Charles Baker, we flew to New York. First time I've ever been on the airplane. I was standing up looking at the bin up there, and my coach said, what are you doing? And I told coach I was looking for the parachute. He said, we just sit down, there's a parachute on. I said, what? Because all the movies I've seen, right, everybody always had a parachute, you know? That was a big surprise to me, there was no parachute.
Yeah.
So anyway, we made it to New York, not needing a parachute, and for the first time, I was running against guys that were fast. I think Mike Larrabee, he had won the Olympic Games in 1964, and Ulysses Williams, all those guys were still running. And Olin Castle, who won the gold medal in the 4x4. I smashed all those guys in the heats in New York. In the quarterfinal, no, in the semifinal, I broke the national record for that competition. for the national championships in America, that was the fastest time anybody ever run during the national championship. I think I ran 45.8 for yards. So that had been like 45.5 for 400 meters in the semifinal. And I had never run that fast before. I had never really run 45. I was running 46.1, 46.2, but I told you it was easy for me.
Mm-hmm.
So when I got with those big guys, man, I dropped down to 45 with no problem.
Mm.
And so I ended up, the next day after the semifinal, I won it in 45.9. You know, I was just learning. I thought I was going to run 44. I don't know. You know, I didn't know what the hell was going on. I was 19. And I had no clue that, you know, what I was doing. And so when I was, you know, you had to sign some papers and all that stuff. So I was going to that procedure. And then I went to this. I had to go to this table over there. I thought, oh, okay. I went up to the table and they said, well, okay, okay, you're the 400-meter champion. Where do you want to go this year? I said, well, I'm going back to San Jose. They said, no. Well, you know, we got competitions in the Germany, Switzerland, Austria, France. And they give all of these countries that you can go to to run races. I said, oh. So I went to Europe and I didn't lose a race. I didn't lose a race in the 400-meter. But I found that the Europeans were very slow. You know, I could win. I could run 47.1 and win the competition.
Mm.
They wasn't with it at all. I think one race, they had one good guy in Germany. What was his name? Anyway, he was on the German 4x4 in Tokyo. And he was a pretty good runner. But, you know, I ran 45.8 and then beat him badly. But that's the only meet that I got psyched up for, to run fast, because the rest of them were small meets. You could stride a 47.1, you know, nobody wouldn't be close.
Wow.
And I would win the 200 meters also. So when I was 19 years old, my first year at university, I was undefeated. Nobody beat me. And I felt strong. Oh, I started getting all these universities started writing me letters, calling me on the phone.
What did you think about that?
Well, I was confused. Really, I was still living at home. And my mother used to come to all my competitions. So I know it was hard for me to leave home because I could have gone from high school to some universities in the South. Southern University in Texas, Southern, all those guys was calling me every night. And my mother and my father was from Louisiana. So, you know, they said that, you know, they told me I could go if I wanted. But I didn't want to, you know, I felt that when my mother would watch me run, I could get power from her, you know. So I was trying to superficially like that because she came to all my meets. And when I would see, if I saw my mother there, I said, oh, I'm not losing today. I said, my mother, she drove about 50 or 60 miles to watch me run. Oh, if I was not my mother, they could forget it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I never lost a race when my mother was in attendance. And so that's why I felt she gave me power like that.
Yeah.
And so I stayed home. You know, that's why I went to San Luis City College. But then my second year of university, I went to San Jose State.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to run 1 year with Tommy Smith, the great sprinter. Tommy the Red Bull. I watched him run. First time I saw Tommy Smith run was in, you know, we used to run I was at Central Union High School in Fresno. We would go to the Lemoore Invitational. Fresno to Lemoore is just about 20 miles, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we used to go to Lemoore Invitational. I would see Tommy was a big hero. I was a little skinny guy. You know, I was running the 600 and the 300 those 2 years. So I used to see him run all day. He used to beat everybody and everything. The long jump, 100, 200, 400, Tommy, I mean, wouldn't know what would be close. And he ran with that beautiful running style. He was very smooth. And I thought, wow. I never knew that one day I would be on the same team with that guy. But that's what happened. Tommy was in his senior year at San Jose State. So we had 1 year to run together. Man, the coach wouldn't let us train together because Bud Winters was our coach. He's very smart. Both of Tommy and I were both winners. So if I'm training with anybody, nobody gets in front of me when I'm training. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm always running. I was training in the front. So one day, Bud had his back turned, I guess, and the assistant coach did not know. I think we was running 200. He didn't know it was running 300. He didn't know. He put me and Tommy together in this 300-meter drill we was running. Oh, man, Bud saw that me and Tommy was in the same 300. He yelled at his team and said, no. I think we must have ran about 33 seconds, you know. Because, mm-hmm. He get in the front, and I get in the front. Oh, and it turned out to be a race, so that's why Coach didn't like for us to train together. He told us, he warned us seriously that we were never supposed to train together. So that was a big no-no. And Coach, the Bud, he bawled out the assistant coach. He said, why did you put those two guys together? So anyway, those are some of the – but anyway, with that sophomore year and Tommy senior year, we broke the world record in the 4x800 meters and the 4x880 meters. We set the American record for the 4x4 and 4x400 meters. We went in 3:03.5, and I think no university had ever run that fast. But so we broke, two records of 4x2 and the 4x4 while we ran together at San Jose State. Mm. Yeah, we were invincible.
It was a good team.
Yeah, and Bud always ran me on the third leg, and Tommy ran the fourth leg. And so when you have to pass the baton to Tommy Smith, there's a lot of pressure on you. And this is what people didn't understand. I would run only about 90% effort. Then as soon as he moved, I go to 100. Because you have to catch him. If you didn't catch him before he got to rolling pretty good, you were never going to catch him. Mm. The last thing I told Tommy, every time, the team's together before we split up, everybody go to their positions. The last thing I told Tommy, I said, Tommy, don't leave early. Because if he left early, you're never going to catch him. So that was my biggest worry. I said, Tommy, don't leave early. Because if he didn't get excited and leave early, we were going to have a good pass because we practiced the baton work all the time. Mm-hmm. And so that was my biggest concern because it would have been a big embarrassment not to give him the baton because everybody came to see Tommy Smith run.
Yeah.
I remember when I was a freshman, I saw a pass, a 4x1 relay pass. San Jose State was running against all these other universities at the West Coast relays. That's in 1966. So I'm watching this, and the third leg for San Jose State, the guy, his name was Ken Knowles. Not Ken, it was Tim Knowles. His name was not it. Okay, well, anyway. Tim Knowles, K-N-O-W-L-E-S. Ken, he couldn't make a pass. Tim, he couldn't make the pass to Tommy. Oh, so he ends up in front of the crowd,
Mm-hmm.
Because it was a 4x1. Oh, those guys who had bet money, they was cussing the guy. I witnessed that. I said, jeez. I said, you don't give the baton to Tommy, people cuss you out. So the next year, I'm that same guy. I got to give it to Tommy. So I was worried that one day I wouldn't get it to him. But I got it to him every time. My secret was I run at 90% and go to 100 as soon as he moved. Man, I had to catch him and give it to him.
You didn't want people to cuss you out.
Exactly. Oh, they would. Yeah. Oh, you slow ass, they could be mean.
Yeah.
But I found out, and I asked my brother, after everybody got mad. My brother said that, my brother, he was one, they used to bet money during the races, which team was going to win.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and somebody gonna make the pass. Oh, these guys had bet money on San Jose State. It was really cool, the guy. So I said, well, I'm gonna make sure I give it to him. And the time that when we set that 4x200 meter world record, I gave it to Tommy on my last step. I knew if I didn't give it to him on this pass, I'm not gonna give it to him. We had a beautiful pass. But it was a lot of pressure on me. And I gave him that baton, man. And I have that picture in my book of me passing to Tommy on that 4x2. Man, I was in my last desperation lunge. And I got it to him, and Tommy ran 19.2 on his relay leg on a dirt track. Now, we're running on dirt track. Ain't no synthetic track right yet. So this is a dirt track. Tommy ran 19.2. Now, Usain Bolt just ran 19.1, set the new world record. But I saw Tommy ease up at 150. So they said, Tommy Smith just ran 19.2. And everybody's going crazy. So I went to where Tommy was. I said, Tommy, I mean, they said you ran 19.2. I said, but at 150, you eased up. He said, yeah. Evan, he said that. I felt a little something. He felt one of his hamstrings, quiver sway. He said he backed off and ran 19.2.
Wow.
Yeah. I'm telling you that Thomas Smith could run. See, Bud Winters didn't believe in lifting weights. If Tommy would have lifted weights, he would have been running what Usain Bolt is running now. Tommy didn't have the power to get going. Tommy was tall and skinny. Tommy was about 6'3 and a half or 6'4. And he weighed about 170 pounds. With Tommy, we were skinny. I won the Olympics at 155. I ran at 159. We didn't lift weight. We were just small guys. Like Michael Johnson, when he ran 1932 in Atlanta, he weighed about 200. He weighed 195.
Oh, wow. It's a big difference.
And all that is power, and power is speed. Speed is power. So we did push-ups and sit-ups, and that's about it. Yeah. But didn't believe in lifting weights. He said a weight should make you tight. But that's old school. You know, that's how he used to thought. He coached a lot of guys back in the 20s and the 30s, and so we was lucky to meet him. He was a great sprint coach.
Yeah.
Bud Winters.
Wonderful.
And anyway, that's why I went to school there. I tell you, when I was making my decision after everybody was bugging me after I won the national championships, I chose to stay at home. I said, no, I'm going to stay on this state. My mother could come see me run every time I run.
Mm-hmm.
Every time we ran at home anyway. And then she would come to the West Coast relays, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But, okay, we almost at the Olympics. Okay, now, so Tommy graduated. Then I was in my third year at university, and this is Olympic year. Oh, boy. And I changed my schedule quite a bit. My first 2 years at San Jose State, I ran cross country. I ran really hard. I could run an 800 and like 147, 148, no problem. But the Olympic year, I said, I'll go, but Tommy was gone, so but he could pay attention to me now. Okay, when Tommy's there, man, he paid attention to Tommy.
Mm.
So he paid close attention to me, and so I didn't run that cross country. During the fall program, he had me doing all of these Indian drills that he knew and we used to do with the team.
Mm-hmm.
And I became a much better sprinter. What he taught me, I got faster. I think my best 200, my sophomore year, I probably ran 20.8, 20.7. But then the Olympic year, I got really fast. I could run 20.5, 20.4, no problem.
Hmm.
I got faster. And so, I was 21. you know, I turned 21 in February 1968. And so, man, I was ready to run. In my diary, I wrote, I will win every race this year. I read, and I, you know, again, I was just like my first year in college. I was undefeated in 1968, just the same as when I was 19. You know,
that's amazing.
But I thought I knew the race. I learned how to run the 400 meters. You know, then I set the world record. In the Olympic trials, I ran 44.06, which was a new world record. And then before that, I set the world record for the 600 meters. I ran 1:14.3 in the 600 meters that stood for 16 years. Johnny Gray broke that after 16 years. He ran 1:14.1, and I had ran 1:14.3. But then at the Olympic trials, I won the Olympic trials in 44.06. Larry James took second in 44.19. And so we went to Mexico City. And, you know, I was a favorite, man. And I was, you know, I didn't like being the favorite. But, you know, I accepted it. I mean, everybody's coming after me. I like to come from behind. The way I ran most of my races, I came from behind. Mm-hmm. I would come from behind because I would be running in third gear. Then in the last 100 meters, I put it in fourth. Because, you know, I didn't get tired in the 400 meters like most people did.
Mm-hmm.
Most guys, you know, at the last 50 meters, they are just, I never did that. I never tied up. I never got tired where I got tight and animated like most guys would do.
Mm-hmm.
I could make guys do that, but I never did it. But so, you know, I never got tired like that. So, and... in Mexico City, I noticed my speed was real good, but Wenders gave me a speed workout. I remember I drove back down. I drove from, you know, we were training in Salt Lake Tahoe, California. That was the Olympic training camp in 1968.
Mm-hmm.
So I drove from Tahoe to San Jose. It takes about almost a 3-hour drive. I drove downhill to San Jose. I told Coach, give me a speed workout. We had two more weeks before the Olympic trials, you know, final. So he gave me a speed workout, and it helped. And so, you know, I ran 44.06. And then Mexico City, I broke the Olympic record in the semifinal. The Olympic record was 44.9. I broke the Olympic record in the semifinal. I ran 44.80-something. It was easy. It was almost like striding, you know.
Mm.
44.8 was low for me right now. And but let me tell you what happened to me in the 400. I mean, the Olympic game was like big in my mind. I said, man, I made the Olympic Games. I'm looking around in the village, and I said, man, I'm in the Olympic Games. I don't even believe it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Let me think. I had a senior moment here. what was that? I was at...
you were going to tell me about the 400-meter final.
Yeah. In the heats, I said, well, I'm going to get a good lead. I'm going to start fast, get a good lead. Then I'm going to slow down and look up in the stands and talk to myself. Say, yeah, I'm running the Olympic Games. This is me. And that's exactly what I did. And everybody, you know, after the race, I said, oh, man, we thought you was trying to break the world record in the heat. I said, no. I said, I just wanted to get a big lead so I can relax and enjoy the fact that I was running the Olympic Games. And that's exactly what I did. And I guess, you know, I was, they thought I was going for the world record. I was leading by far. So I slowed down and I said, I'm in the Olympic Games. I looked in the stands, I looked around, I said, yes, this is me, I'm in the Olympic Games. Then I finished the race. So that, and then after that, I got serious. But I did enjoy being running the Olympic Games. I got a big lead and talked to myself, yes, this is me, I'm in the Olympic Games. And anyway, in the final, Let me tell you how I found out my lane. In a foreign immediate, it's best to be in the inside so you can see your opponent during the race. But I had gotten used to running in the outside. I was very confident. I knew the race. I could run. I could win in lane one. I could win in lane eight. So it didn't bother me what lane I was in. But in Mexico City, Larry James came to our. My roommate was Ron Seaman. Larry James knocked on our door. He came in. This was in the morning and before the finals in the afternoon. I know the lane assignments. I looked at him, and the funny way he was smiling. While I said, "I know you behind me." From that smile on your face. He said, "Yes, I'm in lane two." He said, "Yes, you in lane six, and I'm in lane two, and Ron is in lane one." I said, "Okay." When he left the room, I told Ron Freeman, I said, "Ron, I'm going to win that race today." Then Ron looked at me. He said, "Me too." So we're telling each other we're both going to win the race, right? Mm-hmm. But that's how you have to do. When you come with the Olympic fighter, man, you're trying to reassure yourself. So you tell your friends what you're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
So he's my roommate. I said, "I'm going to win that race." And he said, "Me too." But anyway, being in lane six really didn't bother me that much. My coach always told me that the best lane to have, if you want to set a world record, was in lane six. So, I said, "Well, I'm in lane six, like coach said, And but you should come to the warm up area before they call us to go in to run the race. So, but he was nervous as hell, but Tommy, I used to laugh how nervous Bud got, but he always tried to be pity that nervous. But we watch it, he was more nervous than we were. And after the race, we laughed about it. I said, "Tommy, you see how nervous coach was, but anyway." He came to me and he wiped my brow. One of his funny, but one of it was, he was a different kind of guy. He'd come and he'd wipe my brow and he'd look at his fingers to see if I was sweating, which would tell him that I was warmed up. And I said, "Coach, you think I'm not going to warm up for the Olympic final?" But he's testing to see if I really warmed up or not. And I always like to tell him how I'm going to run the race. So, they always stand there, but this was a ritual of mine. I would tell the coach, this is what I'm going to do. And I told him I was going to start fast, and then I would, check 100 meters, I'm going to run, I'm going to listen to my stride, I'm going to be really smooth, but I'm going to run easy. I said, when I get the 200 meter mark, I'm going to take off. I'm going to probably be the first person at the 300 meters. I'm going to lead into the final. And nobody's going to catch me. And that's what I told Bud. He looked at me and laughed. He said, "I'm not worried about you." I said, "Nah, it's fine." I said, "Yeah." It was him telling me. It was his way of telling me. He said, "I don't worry about you." But then he said, "Look," he said, "don't." He said, "You should run the first 221.6. I said, 21.6. I said, "Coach, that's too slow." I said, And he insisted that I do a 21.6. And I agreed, okay, 21.6. So I go out there, and the first 200, I did 21.4. And I came back with 22.4, around 43.86, a world record that stood for 20 years.
Wow.
And the Olympic record stood for 24 years.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, and not too many people has run 43. Less than 10 anyway in the history of human beings.
That's amazing. That's an amazing accomplishment.
Yeah, and without lifting weights, I'm a coach now. My athletes, I have my athletes lifting weights four times a week. If I'd have lifted weight, man, I'd have ran so much faster. I'd have ran 42, no doubt in my mind. No doubt. Tommy would be running when Usain Bolt is running right now if we'd lifted weights.
Yeah.
Jeez, we were too skinny. I think Tommy, in Olympic final, Tommy told me he weighed 173. I know I weighed 155. That's 50 pounds lighter than what these guys are today,
What a difference.
So we Yeah, big difference. You know, we didn't lift weights. And then we weren't taking all these super vitamins they have now either. You know, they got all these different things they take these days.
Mm-hmm.
We had nothing, man. I think I had a bottle of one of the multiple vitamins my mother bought for me at Safeway. You know.
Yeah.
That's what I took it every day. My mother took it every day. I took it every day. My mother was my vitamin coach, okay? And she gave me one of the vitamins, and that's what I took.
Yeah.
These guys got all these tablets they take.
They do.
You know?
So
yeah.
In 1968 was the first year that they did testing, urine testing. Do you remember having to do any urine tests at the 68 games?
Yeah, they did. They called me for testing as well. After one of the phone meetings, they called me to go pee into a cup. But, you know, I never heard from them again after that. So
mm-hmm.
I guess everything was okay.
Yeah, exactly. So can you tell me a little bit about, so you're a hero to a lot of people and to a lot of athletes, especially for your civil rights activism in the 1960s and at San Jose State. Can you tell me a little bit about that and the Olympic Project for Human Rights?
Well, I was one of the founding members of the Olympic Project for Human Rights. It came out of they had this economic opportunity program. And this gave help for minorities to go to universities. So there was a increase in African Americans going to universities in California at that time. And I was one of them. You know, but I was on an athletic scholarship. But we found it hard to get a housing close to university. You know, when you're being discriminated against, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They went with the house to you because you were black, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we're going through. And that's how we formed the Olympic Project for Human Rights. Out of that problem we were having, it gave us unity, and we could protest and we can complain to the president of the university and things like that. But we didn't... In 1967, I guess it was, when Tommy ran a race in Japan, and they asked him, was a possibility that the blacks might boycott the Olympic Games in Mexico. And Tommy didn't say no, he didn't say yes. I can't remember the exact word he used, but they took it like it was a possibility. And maybe that's what Tommy said, it was possible. You know, we hadn't never talked about that, and the question even surprised Tommy. And Tommy just anything could happen, you know. Tommy answered something like that, and the next thing we knew, we were people was writing us letters, cussing us out, threatening our lives. You know, I said, "Whoa!" So we trying to gather together, man. We didn't even do. I get mail, come to university, oh, we're going to kick you niggas tomorrow. Oh, we're going to give you a ticket back to Africa. All this kind of shit, you know.
Mm.
They would write. At that time, they had this organization called the John Birch Society out of Utah or somewhere, man. These cats were really right-wing racists, you know. They write us threatening letters, and they sent us mock tickets back to Africa. There'd be chicken coops on there, there'd be wildlands, you know, all these things would be on the ship as it takes you back to Africa. All these stereotypes that they gave the black man, you know, with stealing chickens and eating wildlands. All these things were supplied on the ship back to Africa. It was nasty, man. These guys, Jesus, they really hated us.
Mm.
And I didn't hate nobody like that. You know, I didn't hate anybody, you know.
Yeah.
My coach, white, you know, I had white friends. I got along with everybody. And these guys are hating me. And so what it did was it gave us more courage to try harder when we ran. Because, you know, all these people were against us. That's what I got out of it. Yeah. There would be a part of Human Rights. Then we had a big conference in Los Angeles. I forgot the name of it.
The Los Angeles Black Youth Conference?
Yeah, something like that. And this is where we voted to boycott Olympic Games. But, you know, later statements came out that all the athletes would be at the Olympic trials, and at that time, the black athletes at the Olympic trials would take a vote. Because when I first came out, a lot of athletes came out and said, well, how can they utilize it and say, I'm not going to the Olympics because I'm black? You know, they had those kind of complaints. So they said, okay, when we are at the Olympic trials, we have another vote. Of course, the vote was to vote to the games. But to make some type of protest, that, you know, and that's, you know, and that's what happened.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, we were severely ostracized. I didn't understand why. I don't know what we did wrong, but what we did, it drew big awareness to the plight of the university, the black university athletes, the problems we had that were not being solved.
Mm-hmm.
And it also, we were part of the civil rights movement because we were demanding more black coaches, wanted to have the equal housing and all that stuff. You know, everything should be equal. And, you know, just like how, you know, how the women fought, you know, for equal rights. It was the same thing,
mm-hmm.
step by step, everything. You know, when you get that one down, you go for the next one.
Right.
Segregation was tough, and that's why my parents left the South because of Jim Crow, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my parents called it Jim Crow, and what it meant was it was running away from segregation.
Yeah.
You know, my dad, I would tell my dad, oh, Dad, let's go to Louisiana so we can meet your mother. I never met my father's mother, you know, because my dad just didn't want to go back. He would always say, oh, no, he said Jim Crow down there, Jim Crow. And my father hated it. He didn't go back to visit his mother, but he finally did. When I left the house, went to university, he packed my other three brothers and sisters, and he and my mother, they drove to Louisiana, and he saw his brothers and sisters and his mother.
Mm-hmm.
I hated that, missed that trip. But I did finally get a chance to go. I drove across country. My dad, the last time I saw my dad, he drew me a map how to get to his mother's house. And I drove right in front of, with that map, he drew me, I drove right in front of his mother's house.
Mm.
Yeah, but anyway, so I got a chance to meet his brothers and sisters. So the Olympic Project for Human Rights, you know, it came out of us banding together trying to get housing rights. And then it became more political with the proposed Olympic boycott of Olympic Games.
Mm-hmm. What effect did the assassination of Martin Luther King have on the Olympic Project for Human Rights?
Oh, man. I think that was a big tragedy for me. We had just traveled. The San Jose State team, we had just flew from San Jose to Phoenix. To Tempe, Arizona, to run against Arizona State in the dual meet. Once we landed in Arizona, this is when we found out that Martin Luther King had been assassinated. Oh. So we had big discussions. Were we black athletes going to run? We had to take a vote on that. Because, you know, nobody was never the big boss. We were democratic about it, you know. Once somebody came to tell everybody what to do, so we would always vote on it. And so the vote was to compete. And the coach probably said, whew. We competed, and we beat Arizona State. And we came back, and some people were angry with us that we competed. Oh, how come you guys competed after Martin Luther King was shot, la, 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 la. You know, but the people who were standing there at home was never in this position that we were in. You know, they were not in my shoes. You know, it's easy to stand back and talk, you know,
mm-hmm.
when you wasn't there.
Right.
So it gave us energy, made us more angry. Ooh, definitely angry, man. We didn't understand why they shot Martin Luther King. He wasn't talking about violence or nothing like that. You know, that's why they killed Malcolm X. Mm-hmm. Malcolm was talking about violence and tell everybody to get a gun and all that stuff. And then they killed him. But Martin wasn't talking like that.
Mm-mm.
You know, so we were very surprised and disappointed.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, oh.
So how did
was up there.
How did you decide what your protest was going to be at the games? How did you decide what you were going to do at the games to make a statement about civil rights?
Okay, well, this is how it happened. We were in Salt Lake Tahoe. They put us on a bus to Reno. We flew from Reno to Denver, Colorado. They said they wanted to keep us at altitude, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they took us to Salt Lake Tahoe to Reno, then Reno to Denver. And Denver is over 5,000 feet. But we were at 7,000. And they wanted to keep us at altitude, they said.
Mm-hmm.
So we went to Denver to get to get suited. That's where they measured us for our Olympic uniforms, which they would give us when we reached Mexico City. I mean, we were flying Western Airlines, which does not exist anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But Western Airlines, while in Denver, all of the Black Power stuff had quieted down. The Black athletes had voted to attend the games. So there was no controversy about boycott. All that was dead. But then all of a sudden, every Brunswick comes out in the newspaper and says, those Black boys is better. He just talked about us bad. Called us Black boys. He warned us. If they think like that, you know, he just warned us about this, warned us about that, and if those Black, if you Black boys, you know, he talked to us bad.
Mm-hmm.
Called us Black boys. We're university students, right?
Very disrespectful.
Oh, that pissed us off. Oh, he never should have said that. So we had a meeting in Denver to decide what we're going to do. We can't take this, man. This guy come out and call us boys in the newspaper, in the world newspaper, and threaten us, in several ways. I can't even remember. A really stupid guy.
Yeah.
This guy, everyone. And so that really pissed us off. So we had this meeting in Denver to decide what we're going to do, because we said we protest, we should do it in a uniform way. Mel Pindu, who was our most senior, and he was a captain in the Army, he officiated the meeting. You know, and Mel, you know, somebody, he tell you to shut up, you shut up. You know, he'd do it he'll do it the way he would tell a soldier to shut up, you know, right? You come good, bitch, you know. He was the correct guy to run the meeting. People had different suggestions. Okay, everybody run with black socks. Some guys complain, I can't run in black socks. I can't run in any sock. You know, it all kind of complaints. Everything, they said, okay, we run with black armband, you know, in honor of Dr. Martin Luther King. You know, we wanted to have some kind of uniform for them.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I can't run with no black armband. You know, we couldn't get a 100% agreement on everything. But, you know, it would be like, it would always be some guys complained about something. Somebody said, okay, let's paint all the shoes black. And we ever look at each other, then we can't do that. We can't do that because to paint the shoes black, so we cannot come to an agreement. So Mel Penn was getting angry. He was starting to cuss us, you know. And then he said, look, he said, look, all you know, I will tell you the word he said. He called us him up. He was angry because this had been going on for about 2 hours. He cussed us real bad. Then he said, look, we protest by event. You get with your partner and you got to decide what you're going to do. And so a lot of guys just wore black socks. They would raise their black fist, you know, sometime during the ceremony. This was before and after Tommy, you know, in John's
salute.
that the 100 meters, Charlie Green and Jim Hines, they gave the Black Power salute, mm-hmm. but it's not doing the painting of the national anthem. And I think Hines wore black socks, you know, stuff like that. This was showing our blackness and our protest against segregation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not what we were thinking. And so me, Larry, James, Vince Matthews, Rocky, we were the four 400 meter runners. So we had to decide what we was going to do. I can't remember which one came up with the idea. I think it was me. But we would wear black berets. And everybody keep on, okay, we wear black berets while we're on the victory stand. That would identify us with the Black Panthers, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Like we were revolutionary. We were fighting against segregation, right? So that's what we did. We went downtown Denver in black and brought the black berets that we wore in Mexico City. We bought them in Denver.
In Denver?
So, yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay.
We was in Denver to get our uniform.
I see.
And so then we flew to Mexico City on Western Airlines. I bet you never flew Western, have you?
No.
Yeah, out of some big airline sucked them up. I can't remember. It was one of those Southwest, probably Pacific Southwest. Southwest probably took them. But anyway, they flew us to Mexico City. So, you know, as soon as we were right, you know, and I had been in contact with some university students from University of Mexico, and they were protesting against the Olympic Games. You know, they was in touch with us because they were against the games because they said the money should have been used to help poor people instead of spending a lot of money to build this big stadium and having everybody from the whole world come here and do sports. They were protesting against that. And so when the team started arriving, on the same day we arrived, that's just when the Mexican army just killed a whole lot of people.
So I
had arranged to meet with two Mexican students. They said, "Oh, soon you come, you know, call this number. We're gonna meet." Oh man, it was. I never heard from those guys.
Oh really? You never heard from them again?
No, so I'm sure they got killed in that student massacre.
That's really sad.
And, So you know, again. It was good because that frightened me, and I didn't venture far from the village because of that. It frightened me, and I thought, man, those guys must be dead.
That must.
So
have been scary.
I didn't leave the village very often, you know. But anyway, which was probably good because I didn't get what they call Montezuma's revenge.
Yeah.
and they told us, they warned us. He said, "Don't go to the city and eat." They said, "You get the runs, you get Montezuma's revenge." And remember, they gave us some big white tablets, which kind of had us corked up mostly. It was some kind of jock thing. Even if you still eat, and we was taking those not to get diarrhea.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember Wade Bell had not lost 800 meters for about 2 years. I know he didn't lose in a race in 1968. And he won the Olympic trials. He was going to Mexico City as a favorite. He took his parents out to dinner in Mexico City. He got the runs and took last in his heat.
Oh,
you know,
no.
Can you imagine that? Wade Bell from University of Oregon. God, that was a big tragedy. That really got my attention. I think when that happened to Wade Bell, they called a meeting. They said, "Look, we told you guys not to do that, not to do this. You guys better listen to, you know." Oh, after they said that, I think I never left the village again. And I saw Wade Bell go down that easy. I go, "Oh, man." And it was a big shock to me.
Yeah.
Because I said, "I know Wade Bell going to 800 meters." And I thought I was going to win the 400. And I saw how easy he went down. That caught my attention very well.
Yeah, definitely.
And so, you know, but, you know, it didn't get me in. So you told me how we came to the process, and I think I answered that, didn't I?
Yes, yes, you did.
Yeah, we decided in Denver, you know, remember, and from the main meeting, Mel Printer said, you get with your teammate, whoever makes the final, and then you do the same thing. So we said, okay, we wear black berets. That was our protest.
And what was the reaction to your protest?
It wasn't as strong as with Tommy and John. You know, it definitely was not as strong as theirs. You know, you can't top what they did.
So,
but we were glad that we were happy that we did what we decided to do. We didn't let anything influence us. They gave us many warnings not to do anything. If you do this, this is going to happen. Here you go. And even Douglas Roby, president of the U.S. Olympic Committee, he came just before we was leaving the practice field, the warm-up field, to go inside the stadium to run a final. He's trying to talk. He's warning us. I said, Jesus. He's warning us. And this is like 2 minutes before they shoot the gun before the Olympic final. And this guy, I can't remember what he said. My mind was at a blank, man. You know, when before, you know, even 4 hours before Olympic final, man, you got a oneness to your brain about what you got to do. And then this guy's telling you something from Mars, you know. So I think Larry said, come on, you got, Larry broke it up. Larry just, come on. And we ran down the ramp. God, this guy, could you imagine that?
That's awful.
Just before the final. I think he was trying to distract us, and he was warning us. Ooh. And so we go down to the start of the final of the race, and then they hold up our race again. Bob Beamon has just jumped 8.90 meters, and he's on the track, you know, sobbing, you know, and Ralph Boston and Charlie Mays trying to get him off the track because they're trying to run our race.
Yeah.
Yeah, so just after Bob jumped his 8.90 meters, I ran my 43.86.
What a historic day for track and field.
Yeah, yeah. Just minutes after each other.
Wow.
But anyway, yeah. So you had another question?
I was just asking you to describe how other people reacted after your protest, what they said to you or Larry. Or Ron.
We got all kind of letters. The White Angels from London said they're going to shoot us at 2:00. they give you the time.
Oh no.
Yeah. And the 2:00 kind of, all these people was just mad at us, you know. They was threatening to kill us.
Hmm.
You know. So while you out there, you getting ready to run, but you're nervous that somebody might just shoot you dead.
Oh,
no, it wasn't fun at all. But I had my fun in the heat. After that, my fun in the heat of the 400, after that, it was all serious and threats on your life.
Mm.
Yeah.
You're
in the stadium. There are 100,000 people, you know, and you're thinking one of those persons wants to kill you.
Oh, gosh.
And, yeah, so it was difficult.
Very difficult.
When I was 21 years old, you know, weighed about 155 pounds.
So why do you think that the reaction to what you did was less severe compared to the reaction or the punishment received by Smith and Carlos?
Well, I think it was because Tommy and John, they did theirs during the playing of the Star Spangled Banner. You know, our national anthem, and that's what pissed everybody off, I think. Because I was sitting in the stands next to Tommy's wife and my wife, and people started booing and whistling. I said, I didn't understand what they were doing to it. I had no reaction to it. I said, this is what Tommy and John is going to do. I didn't think people would get pissed off. People around us started booing and hissing and whistling. The Europeans were whistling and the Americans were booing. Oh, I didn't understand. It was a big surprise to me.
Do you remember if any of the white athletes expressed support for you?
Oh, yeah. Harold Connolly, Russ Hodge, guys like that, you know. There was some Bill Toomey. You know, some white guys on the team supported us.
Mm-hmm.
Harold Connolly, you know, like the names I just named.
Mm-hmm.
They supported, you know. Bill Toomey would always stand up, and Russ, they would always stand up with us, as well as Harold Connolly. And who else? There's somebody else. Who was it?
Was there some guys from the Harvard?
One of those older white guys, they didn't take any shit. If somebody was messing with the blacks, they'd come and support us, you know.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Hal Conley was a great guy. I was really sorry to hear he died.
Yeah, he died earlier.
I really loved.
Earlier
yeah,
this year?
Yeah, I really
year.
Loved him. Mm-hmm.
Mm. Sad to lose him. So you got to meet Jesse Owens at the 68 games. What was your interaction with Owens then?
You know, I met him before the games.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I met him before the games. I think I met him two times before the games. And we were always coaches. I thought he was a nice guy. I thought he was a wonderful speech giver. He gave wonderful speeches. Oh, he was a good speaker. And, you know, he was behind our time. He came. He called a meeting with us and told us how that we shouldn't wear black socks. That we should have to be careful because when we went back home, we wouldn't be able to get a job. You know, if we would do protests, he was old school. You know,
mm-hmm.
He was old school to us. We didn't really disrespect him that bad. We told him, I said, no, Jesse, we ain't got nothing, you know. We can't do like that again. That's how you guys did it. We're not going to do it like that.
Yeah.
You know, and he got offended, and he cried and left. But we kind of, you know, we didn't shut him down. We didn't cuss him. We would never do that. But we told him, no. He said, no, we're going to do it our way. I said, the way you guys did it is not how we're going to do it. I said, you know, when you came back from the mix, you didn't, you know, you didn't have a job. They didn't give you a job. He had to run against horses, try to make money for his family and stuff like that.
Mm.
You know, it was just of late, they welcomed him back. You know, Avery Brundage threw him out of amateur track and field. Because he ran against something, ran against a horse to make some money. Avery Brundage wouldn't even run anymore. Yeah, the same stupid Avery Brundage.
Yeah. So how did your friends and family react when they found out you were going to be in the Olympic Games?
Well, you know, my brothers and sisters, as well as my mother and father, used to come to all the competitions. We had, here in the West Coast, we had the West Coast Relays. And, you know, they came to all of the small meets as well as the big meets. We had the California Relays out here in Modesto, you know. So they came to all the meets.
So they were not surprised. California. They were not surprised at all. They were prepared that you were going to make it.
Oh, yeah. My mother was praying for me and everything.
Yeah.
And so my mother and father, you know, they drove up to Tahoe for the Olympic trials. They were sitting right there.
Were any of them able to come to Mexico City to see you race in the Olympics?
Yeah, Puma, you know, the shoe companies in trying to get you to run for them would do you favors like that. So Puma told me that they would fly my mother and father to Mexico City, give them a hotel and food and tickets for athletics for the entire games.
And they did
mother,
that?
My mother didn't want to come, so but my father came. My father came, and he had a great time.
Oh, that's
cool. Yeah, you know, they would give you tickets on a certain day for your parents to come inside the village. So one day, I got my father, and he had an entourage. He had three or four guys that followed him around before he went, because he was a father Lee Evans, right? My father had his little entourage. So, you know, they come in, I get in the village. Oh, they were so happy to meet me, and I showed them the rooms we live in, and I think we could take them for lunch. We took them for lunch in where the athletes ate. Oh, my father had his chest all stuck out, and all these guys were falling behind him, you know. Anyway, my father had a great time. My father, he had his chest that way. This is my sadly, world record holder. My father went on when he introduced me to these guys. It was funny.
Yeah.
But anyway, I remember showing him around the Olympic Village. He had a great time.
Yeah.
And he was there. He was there during the entire game.
Oh, wow. So he saw you win your gold medals?
Pardon?
Did he see you win your gold medals?
Yeah, my father saw me win the gold medal.
Mm-hmm.
He saw me win the gold medal in the 400 and the 4x4 relay.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, he was there.
Wonderful he got to see that. That's wonderful that he got to see that.
Yeah. Oh yeah, it was great. When I came back, I asked one of my brothers, did they watch it on television? And they said, yeah, it said that we watched it with Ma, with my mother and the other brothers and sisters. And they said my mother, she knew everything you were doing. They come out to my brother Jim and said, yeah. He said, Lee looks like he's talking. When we were standing behind our blocks before they said, run us on your mark. My mother said, you pray. Remember, she and I asked her exactly what I was doing. I was praying. She said, Jimmy, my son, he knows my lips were moving. And Mama said, he's praying. I said, wow, I was praying then. after the race, they said my mother was crying, and she said that he came from me. She was so proud, And she said that he came from me, and really made her feel great,
Yeah.
And I'll never forget my brother told me that.
Oh.
That he said he came from me.
How sweet.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened after?
Yeah, my
the
mother
game?
Was very. Pardon?
What happened after the games when you came home? Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, it was kind of difficult for me. A lot of people were angry with me because they said, how come you didn't do what Tommy and John did? But I said, that's not what we had decided to do. And, at the university, some of Carlos's friends and people, they would ostracize me in some kind of way. And I would tell them, I said, if you wanted to do that, how come you didn't make the team and do it? don't be telling me what to do.
Mm-hmm.
I said, if you wanted to do that, you should have made the team and did it. I would tell them that. They finally got off my back.
That's a very good retort.
Yeah. They love the Lord.
I like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then what happened with your career in track and field, and how did you transition from running to being a coach?
Well, I always knew I wanted to coach. I really had admired all of my coaches, from Stan Dow in high school, and Coach Dow coached me after university as well. But then Coach Baker my freshman year, and then Bud Winters, and I learned from all of them. I was watching and I was learning, and Bud knew how I was, because I was very observant. I was asking many questions, and I was captain of our track team my senior year, my junior year. I was captain of our team, and he saw my leadership qualities when I was captain. And, we won, it was 1969. We won the NC2A championship that senior year, and it was work. I really worked hard to keep that team together, but we won the NCAA championship in 1969. And so I had been helping recruiting all the time out of San Jose State. I would recruit, like what they call Speed City. Me and Art Sundberg, we recruited Speed City, the two of us, I went after John Carlson when I would see them we'd be on the tour, Billy Gaines, Martin McGrady, Art went and got Jerry, Art Sundberg went and got Jerry Williams, Ted Banks recruited Sam Davis and Bob Griffin, you know, from junior colleges. Ted Banks was the assistant track coach under Bud. And pretty soon, man, we and Frankie Slayton was from, he was from Oakland, and he transferred in from, what's the name of that junior college? I guess it was Merritt Junior College in Oakland. And so all of a sudden, we had all these sprinters, and we were, you know, we had the best sprint coach in the world, so they called us Speed City. You know?
Yeah.
And so then I graduated. And then 1 year after I graduated, Bud Winters resigned. He retired. And then I was appointed assistant track coach at San Jose State when I was 22 years old.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I wasn't ready for that at all. But it was just how I got started, yeah, in coaching. Bud, you see, that was Bud, his return favor for me. I remember I told Bud, I said, Bud, you know, I'm going to be a great track coach like you. I said, I'm going to get me about two or three guys like me. And we won the championship. And he started laughing. I said, what'd you laugh about? He said, if you find one athlete like you, your whole career, you'll be very lucky.
Oh.
And I didn't understand what he meant, but now I understand because I haven't found one like me yet. Bud knew what he was talking about. So he really did. So I really appreciate him telling me that, but I thought I could prove him wrong, but I couldn't. He said, you never find another girl like you. And so, wow, I said, but now I can appreciate what he said, because I haven't found one. I've been coaching for over 40 years now.
And you still haven't found anybody like you?
No. No.
And you've looked all over.
I could run 800 through 200. That was unusual. I think I could probably run 100 too, but because I could be on a 4x100 meter relay, and the guy that runs 99, he gets it 3 or 4 yards in front of me. I'll catch him and pass him. So I know I had good speed, you know. But I just didn't like running 100 meters.
Yeah. And you looked all over the world, I hear, right? You've spent quite a bit of time in Africa. Can you tell me about that?
I've worked. You know, I came to Nigeria in 1975, but the first time I went to Africa was in 1969. Kip Tino, the famous runner from Kenya, he invited me to two races. I ran two races in Kenya, 1969. I ran in Mombasa, and I ran in Nairobi. But anyway, I came to Nigeria just to work. I had received an invitation. After I won my gold medal, I had an invitation from Mr. Isaac Akioye from the University of Ile-Ife in southwest Nigeria. He said, you are welcome to come. I'm teaching coach at the University of Ife Institute of Physical Education at any time. So I wrote him back. I said, and he left his address. I said, when I finish university and get some experience, I'll come. So he and I communicated for the next 8 years. And I finally made it there, 1975. And
what was it like? What were your first impressions of Nigeria?
Wow, that it was crowded. There was a lot of people in Lagos, man. I said, this is not like Kenya. Oh, what happened? You know, Kenya was very different from West Africa, you know.
Yeah.
And so, if I got to the stadium, I was happy because there were some wonderful athletes that sitting there when I got there. I mean, they was doing what they thought was training. My first group of athletes were very good when I arrived in Lagos. There's some group of athletes just would come to the national stadium there in Surulere, and all of them, 100% of them got scholarships to the U.S. and left me after 1 year. Because, you know, I transformed them into athletes that could run fast enough to get scholarships to the U.S. And this helped this was started to influx a lot of Nigerians into track and field in America. It was me. Because in 1 year, I get about two or three guys running 10, 200 meters. I get four or five guys running 46 in the 400, maybe one running 45. Next thing I know, they're gone. So I always had to go find some more, you know. So that was a pretty good system they had there for a while. But now the American government's got more stricter with Nigerians getting visas. So you don't see as many Nigerians coming to America to run anymore like they used to. But that's how I got started in Nigeria. You know, the people, they welcomed me. After they saw that I was a very good coach, you know, they loved me after that. Because when I got there, I think the national record was like 46.6 or something. They thought that was fast. But before I left, I had them running faster than that in training, you know. So, you know, I got a chance to work with Innocent Egbonike, who was the African world record holder for about 16 years. He ran 44.17. When he was with me, he was a sprinter. And then he got a scholarship to America. I said, Innocent, change to the 400. I said, in America, there's about 50 guys that run 10.300 meters. That's what he could do. So he changed to the 400, and man, the rest is history. Mm-hmm. He made some Olympic finals and world championship finals.
Well, that's wonderful. So I've heard you've also been doing some humanitarian work in Africa. Can you describe some of that?
To me, my coaching is doing really humanitarian work. you have to give so much to those athletes. They don't have shoes. You end up giving them almost everything, you know, the equipment to run, and you end up helping them a lot. But, you know, I've been involved with starting a school in Liberia, and they're trying to do some farming in Liberia. You know, these are the type of things that I have. Goals that I've set for myself, and you know, I've done a lot of that. I received the Nelson Mandela Humanitarian Award with Wilma Rudolph back in 1994.
Congratulations!
And thank you. Yeah, they gave us that in Perugia, Italy. That was the last time I saw Wilma Rudolph.
Oh.
You know, because she died just before the 96 game, and. The 96 game was the first Olympic Games I ever went to, and Wilma wasn't there.
Oh.
You know, I really missed her.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But anyway, I received the NCAA Silver Anniversary Award. That goes to the student athletes who have achieved good things, and did some humanitarian work like I had been doing in Africa, and from your experience at the university.
Mm.
And this is how they give this award. They combine what you did and what you're doing now. And I won the award. Okay, in my graduation class, it was Jim Ryan. This was in like 1994. This is 25 years after you graduate from university. They see who's accomplished great things. It was me, Jim Ryan. Who's this? Some famous running back. What's his name? Some famous running back. I can't think of his name right now.
Jim Brown?
No. It wasn't Jim Brown. I'm not that old. can't remember his name. But anyway, I think his son plays NBA basketball.
Oh.
It's not Harding. His son plays NBA basketball. But I'll think of it later.
Okay.
But he was in that class, as well as Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Uh-huh.
Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Jim Ryan, myself, and Bill Hurd, who was an optometrist who attended Notre Dame University.
Sounds like a wonderful
and who hit a hole in one yesterday. He sent me an email to me. He hit a hole in one. Dr. Bill Hurd. That one went around the world, you know.
Yeah. That's funny. Well, before we close the interview, is there anything else that you wanted to tell us about so that we could, you know, get it in the archive? Anything else that you wanted to put on the record?
Well, you know, my objective is to be a farmer in Africa that provides food for the local people at a cheap price. I also want to have a school right next to the farm so that the students can participate in the harvest and learn about farming and to even, you know, and of course be able to eat some of the harvest. But that's my objective right now in life. That's what my wife and I is working towards. She's a Liberian. Yeah.
That's wonderful. That's a wonderful goal.
These are our objectives.
So what advice would you give to somebody else who wanted to be in the Olympics?
Wow. Well, for me, it just snuck upon me, you know. And I think this is how it's going to happen. I mean, it's fun the way it happened to me. Well, I say fun. After I won the national championships when I was 19, I didn't know what I had done. And so we're flying back to San Jose from New York, and I was thinking, I said, Coach, if this was an Olympic year, would I go to the Olympics? He said, he's the best in the country. And that's when it dawned on me. I said, wow, I can go to the Olympics, you know. And I told you, on my first plane ride, left New York, flying to Brussels, Belgium, for my first international tour, I was sitting next to Ralph Boston. I couldn't believe it. I was sitting next to Ralph Boston in the airplane. And my mind was completely blown, you know. So, what was the question? I've lost what the question was.
I said, what advice would you give to somebody who wanted to be in the Olympics, like a young athlete who wanted to make it?
Well, if it could happen the way mine did, it would be, it's more fun, I think. But they would have to get started pretty early now. They would have to get a good private coach in these days, because now athletics, track and field has become very technical. You have to get started early, got to get it earlier, and be able to afford a technique coach and stuff like that. I know that's my objective now. I want to have another child and teach him. And I'm working with some young children in Nigeria now, you know. I'm director of coaching for a team incorporated where we have a four-year contract with the Cross River State government in Cross River State in Nigeria. So I'm working with primary and senior secondary high schools. Starting from primary to high school. These are the children I'm working with now.
So how young do you think someone who wanted to do track, like the 400 meter, how young do you think that they would need to start?
Right now, I'd say about 10 years old.
Okay.
About 10. I started when I was 14. You know, it's for the first time I ran races. And when I was 15 is when I really started racing, you know. But it would be the advantage. It would be the advantage to be able to have good technique, to get them to know something about it, and to get agility drills. Because right now they don't have physical education in schools anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so you know what they taught us, what the kids these days don't get taught early is how to tumble. With this, everyone had to learn how to tumble, you know, how to roll, get up and land on your feet. This is teaching us coordination. This year they don't teach anybody anything, and everybody's fat. You know, but there was physical education was required. You know, when I went to school,
mm-hmm.
then and that was our 45 minutes of release, man. We go crazy at it. And now they keep those kids cooped up, and then they wonder why they act so bad. Let them get out there and run.
Right.
But now, you know, that's what I did. We played every sport, you know. And so I would say let them get started when they're young. And then as soon as they get strong, by the time they're 12, 13, I start teaching the Olympic lifts with a bar. You know, not with any weight, but with the bar. Start teaching the techniques of the Olympic lifts, and they'll be a little bit stronger. This way, you know, they want to be successful as they run in their schools. Mm-hmm. So, and by having working with someone when they're young, they're going to dominate in their schools if they have any talent, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I was able to dominate just off natural, you know. Everything just fell into place for me.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's important they start about 10 years old and have somebody to start teaching them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The basics.
Well, is there anything else that you want to tell us about before we wrap it all up?
No, that's it.
Well, thank you so much, Lee. It's been an honor to speak with you today. And like I said, you're a hero to so many athletes and to people who study the history of the civil rights movement. And I really appreciate you taking the time out of your schedule to speak with me today.
Okay, yeah, I'm sorry for bouncing you around at first, but I was on the move. Tell me a little bit about yourself. Are you... If you don't mind.
No, I don't mind at all. I'm going to stop the recorder.